This is where we live.
Today's a good day, and we're going to celebrate today and wait to see what the future holds.
That's former Hartford Mayor Eddie Perez talking to WFSB-TV after a state appeals court overturned his conviction on corruption charges. Now we're looking at two new trials in a case that's been dragging on for years. It's just one of the stories we will tackle in our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We'll also be looking at Democratic fundraising, get an update on the lockout at Lawrence and Memorial Hospital in New London, and look ahead to the Newtown shooting anniversary. You can join us as always, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email us wherewelive at WNPR.org. You can tweet us at wherewelive. And you can always find our show page at WNPR.org. Joining me as always is Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Joining me from the Connecticut Mirror, the Capitol Bureau Chief, Mark Pazniokas. Hello, Paz.
Good morning.
And Jeff Cohen is WNPR's Capital Region Reporter. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, John.
Well, let's start with you, Jeff, and talk about this Eddie Perez story. You updated us a little bit the other day. Maybe you can just quickly get our listeners up to speed about what has happened and what's going to happen next.
Sure. Well, just to rewind a bit, back in 2010, a jury convicted the former mayor of the city of Hartford on various corruption-related charges. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison. The issues, there were two separate issues, two separate cases, essentially. One was a bribery case and one was an alleged extortion case. He was convicted on both, but the judge allowed it all to be tried at once. One jury, one judge, one case, one time. And that was done over the objections of the mayor's attorneys and the mayor, they were overruled. And then they appealed after the conviction, saying, look, these two cases never should have been joined. Because essentially the idea is, look, how can he get a fair trial in the second trial if in Hubie Santos, Perez's attorney's words, he told the appellate court, look, if the jury's already decided at the end of the first case that my guy is a liar, a thief, and a crook, well, how can they fairly consider him on the second case? So that was the basis of the appeal, and that's what we heard from this week.
And you talked about this a little bit on your show earlier this week, Colin. This is from a legal standpoint, this is a very interesting case, the way this has turned out, notwithstanding any of the merits of the case against Eddie Perez. This has just been an interesting question.
Yeah, well, first of all, on the merits of the case against Eddie Perez, the appeals court was unequivocal. They basically said, oh, no, the facts are there to convict him. You guys just did it the wrong way. And, you know, I think it raises a whole bunch of questions. But, you know, this was supposed to be, in some ways, the showcase of the state's attorney's ability to try public corruption cases. For a long time, whether we're talking about Giordano or Ganim or Rowland or you name it, these are all federal cases. And this was going to be the state's chance to really take a whack at it. And it really is kind of in ruins at this point. I mean, two new trials is not good news. I doubt very much there will be two new trials. My guess is this now goes into a very different tenor of plea agreement conference. But, you know, it's not necessarily the state's attorney's fault that things came out this way, but it's not good either.
Paz?
Yeah, I think you'll hear you won't hear because it'll be done very quietly. But this does seem to cry out for some type of plea deal. You know, the word was before the first trial, there was some chats and that Mayor Perez was unwilling to consider a guilty plea. He now knows what his exposure is. There was a 3-year prison sentence that's hanging over his head. So you're in a very different bargaining posture as far as knowing what the downside is. And if you can get something off of 3 years, you know, you're thinking it could be pretty good. Because as Colin said, it was a mixed victory at the appeals court, to say the least.
And Jeff, we're not hearing anything from Hubie Santos, Perez's attorney, somebody who occasionally likes to say a thing or two to the press, and now he's not saying anything at all.
That's right. The state, however, has said we are prosecuting this case either by – we haven't decided how, but we're going to continue – either by filing an appeal with the Supreme Court of the appellate court ruling or by prosecuting two new trials. So that didn't take them a whole lot of time to come up with that, and so they seem resolute. It is worth noting again that as all of this is playing out, that like what Colin said, there is the appellate court said there is sufficient evidence to convict, and they went through pretty comprehensively, if you read the opinion, and went through and on all of the charges and said there is sufficient evidence. That doesn't convict him. What it does is it doesn't acquit him. It doesn't say that you shouldn't bring this case again because you don't have the goods. They say you have the goods. You just sort of screwed up along the way.
But I just want to make sure, Colin, I understand this. So we went through a trial in which one of the problems was that one case was essentially prejudiced by the other. The same jury is listening to some testimony and not supposed to be listening to other testimony. That all gets thrown out. And now maybe we have two new trials. Maybe we don't. But with the appeals court essentially saying, well, you got the stuff to convict him. He's already been convicted. People have been talking about Eddie Perez being a convicted mayor on corruption charges for years. I mean, does Eddie Perez get a fair trial after this many years of this hanging out there?
You know, I mean, obviously that's an open question, but that's an open question with a lot of cases. I mean, I remember when they were trying to impanel an Ollie North jury that didn't know anything about Ollie North. You know, that always comes up. And obviously it comes up in a different way now because there has been this conviction. But I also don't think prospective juries carefully read the decisions of appeals courts. I think what's more material is what Jeff said, which is that now each side knows the strength of each other's case. And one of the things that Hubie Santos knows is that they are capable of pursuing and getting a conviction on both of these counts. And it's, you know, I mean, we're talking kind of about a technicality, a really important technicality, but kind of about a technicality. So even though I think Eddie Perez and Hubie Santos they're in a much better bargaining position than they were pre-trial, just because, you know, the state doesn't want to do two more trials. But the one thing that they do know is that if they go to trial, they might lose again.
And the other thing that the former mayor and Hubie Santos knows is the obvious. The former mayor is the former mayor, right? You bring these kinds of cases against active politicians because if you're the state, you don't want allegedly corrupt politicians in office. Does that change the plea negotiations now that he's out of office? I can't imagine that it doesn't.
Does anybody know if he pled out but accepted a felony conviction? Could he run for mayor again? Let's say he didn't do jail time. Could he run for mayor?
You can. Yeah. You can get your voting rights restored. Jeff and I actually were talking about that before we went on.
Can you run for mayor and serve for mayor if you don't have voting rights?
No, I do not believe so. Okay. The standard to run for any office in Connecticut is you must be an elector, and that means you have the right to vote.
We're talking with Mark Pazniokas, Jeff Cohen, and Colin McEnroe in the Wheelhouse today, tackling some of the news of the week, as we always do on Wednesdays. You can join us at 860-275-7266. So the story of corruption charges against Hartford's former mayor, not over yet. There's another current scandal happening at City Hall that Jeff Cohen has been following, and there's new news on this. This is the case of one Earl O'Garrow, and you can maybe quickly take us through where we are with this case, but there's new information. There's more money owed than we even thought, Jeff.
That's right. So just to back up, Earl O'Garrow is an insurance broker, or was an insurance broker. He since had his license revoked by the state. And the allegation early on from people inside the school system and some at City Hall was that he got city business through the treasurer's office, or with the aid of the treasurer's office, something the treasurer's office denies. That's city treasurer Adam Cloud. At the same time that he was doing business with Treasurer Cloud's family, renting office space in their downtown office area, and hiring Cloud's brother, Chris Cloud, to be his lobbyist. So that was the allegation. Then why do we care about it? Well, because the city gave him $670,000 to pay its insurance premiums, and then he never did. Turns out he didn't pay a lot of people's premiums from other companies, if I recall. And a lot of people are owed a lot of money, including lenders on his home out in Marlboro. So that's the backstory. We know that he defaulted earlier on $125,000 state loan and grant package from the state to move his offices from Windsor to the Cloud Building in downtown Hartford.
And this is money that he got with help from the lobbyist from the Cloud family or not?
Yes.
Okay. So he took some state money to move downtown. So that's one of the things that brings us to the why do we care. But now we're finding out there's more state money
That's
involved?
Right. Yesterday, the State Department of Economic and Community Development informed us, pursuant to an FOI request that we had submitted, that he also owed them – that they had also given him another $500,000 loan. Rather, they had agreed to give him another $500,000 loan. They had only paid out half of it, about $250,000. And that loan was for him over 3 years to hire 30 people by the end of the 3 years at an average salary of just over $50,000 to grow his business. That loan, interestingly enough, closed in early – or that agreement was signed in early August, just about the time that his business started really unraveling in a rapid fashion.
So essentially now what we're finding out is there's more state money involved, and it was being given to him at a time at which it didn't seem like he was necessarily a great investment. Colin McEnroe, look, we're just hearing this past week Governor Malloy signing something that Kevin Limbo, the state comptroller, has been working on for some time, trying to provide some transparency in how the state DECD actually spends money like this. When we hear something like this in the Oguero case, it takes us outside a little bit of intrigue around City Hall and an investigation by federal officials into what's happening there. And it really makes us look again hard at how the state spends its money.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of, you know, in all the things with the Oguero case, there's always sort of two questions. One of them is, you know, what of a totally irresponsible nature did Earl Oguero wind up doing? That's sort of the question we wind up focusing on, like taking money and not taking loan money and not paying it back, or taking insurance premiums and not using them to buy insurance. And then there's this other question about whether government was doing what it was supposed to do in the first place. I even have questions about that with the insurance. I'm not 100% sure I believe that the city needs that much excess liability insurance. I hope someday that we can try to figure out what did they spend all that money on, and why do they have an insurance broker and call them up and say, I need $670,000 right now. You're about to lose your excess liability insurance. But here, yeah, there's a whole bunch of questions about whether these loans should be made at all. And I actually find the first loan more dubious than the second loan, oddly enough. The first loan was to move from Windsor to Hartford. Now, this doesn't grow jobs. This doesn't create economic growth. It doesn't do anything. It moves somebody from one town to another. You know, and so for him to get $100,000 or whatever it was to do that, I don't understand what that's all about. It doesn't seem to fit within the realm of DECD's mission.
Well, he could have swapped space with ING, which got state money to move from Hartford to Windsor.
They were probably looking for a lot more space, though, I would guess.
I believe you're right.
Well, so does this at all, you know, this piece of this story unraveling a little bit, Paz, start to point back at this larger question about how the state spends money, whether or not it's any company to move from one town to another, or whether or not it's the judgment of spending money on someone who seems to have done some pretty dubious dealings?
Well, yeah. I mean, the unanswered question here is what role political coziness played in all this. You know, the DECD engages in kind of a high-risk game about trying to retain and grow jobs. You know, when it comes to dealing with the big boys, there's always the question of, is there a genteel form of extortion going on? If you don't help us, we'll go elsewhere. I mean, you see Boeing right now, which is swimming in money with all the plane orders. They're holding up the state of Washington, you know, for millions, if not, I think it's in excess of $1 billion. So there's that larger issue. Now you go small bore. Here you have a really small player, no track record, hires a lobbyist who's connected with a very politically well-connected family. You know, Chris Cloud's dad, Adam Cloud's dad, was very close to Chris Dodd. In fact, Chris Dodd's Senate office was the tenant in the space, right, that Oguero ended up with.
It went Dodd, if I'm correct, it went Dodd, Blumenthal, Oguero.
Yeah. So, you know, there's that aspect to it. I mean, did people take a hard look? What was it like, well, this guy has some connections. It's some jobs in the city and sometimes. And if the numbers had worked out on that last loan, it would have been one of the better ones. Number of jobs for the amount of money put on the table, it would have been one of the higher ratios of jobs to money out the door. But it sounds like this is a sunk cost.
It was a made-up number, I think.
Yeah, well.
And also in Treasurer Adam Cloud's defense, speaking of the Clouds, Adam has long said throughout this whole thing that he did nothing wrong. And he has also said, look, is it so bad that I have my eye on helping grow minority businesses in the city? It's an argument he's made before when he's gotten to a little bit of, not trouble, but controversy. That's an argument that he makes. It's a legitimate argument. The outstanding question is whether or not, in so doing, he may have gotten himself into even bigger trouble.
My prediction? Eventually, Earl Oguero will hire Hubie Santos as his lawyer. Maybe that's why we can't get Hubie on the phone right now. And Michael Skakel and Eddie Perez and Earl Oguero will open up a restaurant together 5 years from now.
It's been a hell of a month for Hubie, hasn't it?
Peyton Manning isn't having that good a month.
We're talking with Colin McEnroe, Mark Pazniokas, and Jeff Cohen in the wheelhouse today. It's our weekly news roundtable. When we come back, we'll be joined by WNPR business reporter Harriet Jones. She's been covering the ongoing, seemingly deadlocked negotiations at Lawrence and Memorial Memorial Hospital. We'll also reflect later in the show on Nelson Mandela, who met with Connecticut's congressional delegation back in the early 90s. You can join us, 860-275-7266. Email wherelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We're tackling the news of the week with Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Jeff Cohen, WNPR's Capital Region reporter, and Mark Pazniokas, the Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. We'll be taking some of your calls in a moment at 860-275-7266 about some of the news stories you're following this week. One of the things we've been following this week, the labor negotiations at Lawrence and Memorial Hospital in New London have broken down, and the impact is being felt by workers. Lynn Betta and her partner both work at the hospital.
There's no income coming in our household right now at all, but, you know, we're quite frugal people anyway, so, and we did save for the strike. We knew it was going to come to this.
I want to bring in Harry Jones, WNPR's business reporter, who also lives in southeastern Connecticut. She's been following this closely. Hello again, Harriet.
Hi, John.
Maybe you can give us an update. What exactly is this strike and now lockout all about?
Well, the substantive issue that's at stake here is job security. So they were negotiating a new 3-year contract for about 800, both registered nurses and LPNs and techs. The two unions involved want language in that that new contract that says if L&M moves services off the main hospital campus, which they have done in the past few years, that unionized staff will be allowed to follow that work, will still be employed when that work is moved off campus. Now, the hospital says it won't insert that language, that it will give job security for 90% of registered nurses, for 50% of techs, but it won't give the specific language about if it moves work off campus that unionized workers will be allowed to move with it.
So there was a short 4-day strike followed by now a lockout, and talks have broken down. How many workers are being affected, and is work getting done at Lawrence and Memorial Hospital, and what's the impact on patients right now?
Yeah, that's interesting. It's a little hard to tell. So 800 workers have been locked out. This is now the 11th day of the lockout. The hospital has hired in between 150 and 250 replacement workers. They will not be specific about what work is not getting done. They say they are doing now elective surgeries once again, which they weren't doing during the strike. But it seems fairly clear that, you know, they must be operating on a reduced schedule given, you know, the lack of staffing that they have. And it's interesting, if you talk to some of the doctors in the hospital, there's disagreement about the quality of the staff that's been hired to do this work behind. Some people are very pleased with them. Other people say, you know, the work in the hospital now is substandard.
And the other thing that you've been following, of course, is the impact on these workers. The longer this goes on, the more difficult it is for them. And, of course, there's even concerns about health care coverage and that sort of thing. What's happening with the workers right now who are locked out?
Yeah, indeed. Because L&M is self-insured, they're not required to provide health insurance anymore for these workers. They say they are now eligible for COBRA. Also, because they are locked out now and not formally on strike, there's disagreement about whether they're eligible for unemployment benefits. I think there is a case now going to the Department of Labor that will be decided within a week as to whether they can now apply for unemployment. But yes, this is very hard on a lot of people who may not have been anticipating that this would go on as long as it has. They originally planned for a 4-day strike. The lockout then began at the end of that, so they've been out of work for a further 11 days now. And it's very difficult to see where this is going to go. Yesterday was supposed to be the first day of substantive talks since the lockout began. It was cancelled just the night before. It was cancelled Monday night. And just to give you a sense of how difficult this has become, the two sides couldn't even agree on who had cancelled the talks.
Harriet Jones, WNPR's business reporter. She's been following the story of the lockout at Lawrence and Memorial Hospital, affecting some 800 workers there. You can read more at WNPR.org. Thanks as always, Harriet. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
We're going to move to another labor story. State Attorney General George Jepson has decided to negotiate with unions and withdraw a Supreme Court appeal of the case against former Governor John Rowland. Here's Attorney General Jepson.
Difficult choice, but one I'm very comfortable making, one that I'm very confident is in the best interest of the taxpayers of the state of Connecticut, we'll see. We hope and believe that the unions will be there negotiating in good faith. We certainly will be, and we'll see if an outcome can be reached.
So, Colin, as we get into what this negotiation is over, let's just backtrack a little bit here. What exactly was the ruling against the state and essentially the former governor, John Rowland?
Well, first of all, before you even go there,
since
you mentioned the former governor, John Rowland, one of the other little subplots here, and I hope Paz can help me summarize what the actual ruling was, but there's another subplot that's going on right now, which is that there actually are two different parties to this case. The ruling, George Jepson is talking about the ruling against the state, but also John Rowland and I think his budget chief, Mark Ryan, are also parties to this case, and the state actually provides you and me and all of us taxpayers, we provide John Rowland and Mark Ryan with counsel, I think in the form of Daniel Clough, in case
you're
on the wheelhouse. So that and so what's happened here is the state has decided, in the form of George Jepson, has decided it is not going to appeal to the Supreme Court. John Rowland has decided no such thing. And I think it is no certainty at this point at all. I mean, I think if I had to bet, I would bet that he will appeal to the Supreme Court. But we need to explain the case, too.
Well, very quickly. I mean, in 2003, Rowland's relationship with labor, which for a Republican governor had been pretty good, it went south in a hurry. He issued layoff orders for about 2,800 workers. The union claimed that Rowland had a budget crunch. I mean, does this sound familiar, guys? And the union's claim was Rowland ignored where he would save money by laying off. And instead, he went after unions that would not come to the bargaining table. And it was punitive.
It was retaliatory.
It was retaliatory. Young. And the Second Circuit, in a basically a declaratory ruling, said, as a matter of the law, Rowland broke the law, that Rowland violated the First Amendment rights of people to assemble and organize as unions. And kicked it back to the trial court to just deal with the matter of damages. So that's where it is. There is a finding by a unanimous ruling of a three-judge panel at the Second Circuit. And the state's looking at a big, big number. Molloy and Jepson, two Democrats facing re-election next year, face a little bit of a political pickle, which is, you know, nobody really wants to write a big check to the unions in election year. You're going to get hammered one way. On the other hand, you need the unions to be reelected as a Democrat in this state. So when Jepson announced last summer and then finally filed the petition in October that he was going to seek a review by the Supreme Court, the public sector unions in Connecticut were pretty frosted with Jepson. I mean, they've had some other issues with him that go back to when he was Senate Majority Leader and he helped reject an arbitration award for correction officers. So there is – this thing is loaded with history. But anyway, that's where it is. So this was really a reversal by Jepson. You know, he's saying, look, the odds of the Supreme Court taking up the case – are low. I don't think there is, you know, he says, well, they only take up 1% of cases. Trust me, attorney generals who are coming before them with a labor management rights case are going to get a harder look than, you know, an inmate filing a habeas petition.
I think that number also comes from, and you have this embedded in your story, a very amazing and interesting and amusing letter to Jepson from David Golub, who's probably, if there's a legal genius in Connecticut, it's David Golub, and he's representing these unions. And I think that 99-1 number comes from that letter. I mean, the letter is really worth reading just because it really is a letter to George Jepson saying, you want to figure out how to get out of this? Here's how to get out of this, all right? You're not appealing this, and here's why you're not appealing this.
So Jepson's position is that, yes, I am withdrawing the petition, but in effect, I am really suspending the appeal, that if we can't reach a settlement, you'd have to then let it play all the way out, have a trial judge come in with a final judgment. Then we can appeal to the Supreme Court, and at that point, you'd see what the number is. But you know, nobody will say exactly what the number is going to be, but it's going to be a big number. It's going to be tens of millions of dollars.
So it's going to be tens of millions of dollars. But just get back quickly to Colin's point here. Do you think that there's a chance that there's a separate John Rowland appeal to all this?
Yeah, I think it'll be a fly in the ointment. Yeah, go ahead.
The problem with that is trying to attract the attention of the Supreme Court will be a lot harder for Larson and Ryan. I mean, Rowland and Ryan. Whose issues are slightly different. They're not as sexy, I think, as far as the Supreme Court would view them. And the question is, would the state continue to finance that?
I mean, there's a protocol that I don't entirely understand about whether the state can stop trying to. The one thing that we do know is the state cannot indemnify Roland against punitive damages. If there's punitive damages directed at him, he's on his own there. I don't think they can do that. How much flexibility they have about whether they continue to pay for his legal representation all the way up to the Supreme Court, I don't know. But back to the thing that you were saying before, too, I do think that for George Jepson, it was would have been a hard thing to say to the state unions. Yeah, I'd like Justice Scalia to have a look at this case. I mean, that was a politically unappetizing prospect.
It was. But the other political piece was to settle the case. You know, it was almost – I'm not saying Jepson was doing this, but, you know, you could almost see a scenario in which he was winking at the union and say, look, let me do this. Mm. At that point, we will have exhausted our appeals, and then I can sit down with you and talk a serious number. Because it's really politically unpalatable for somebody to reach a settlement and just say, here, even if it was as a result of an action by a Republican governor a decade ago.
And we just got a tweet to somebody asking, would the Roland case set precedent? I assume that what they're asking is, would that set precedent if indeed it makes its way to the Supreme Court in some way? And that's probably something that the labor unions don't want to have any part of with this court.
Well, municipal officials, the Connecticut Association of Boards of Ed filed an amicus brief because they said, hey, this is kind of a scary precedent the other way, that what the Second Circuit said is municipalities, state governments have to be really careful how they use the threat of layoffs. Now, David Golub says, no. Roland did some things that were really beyond the pale, that the impact is not as broad as they think. But there are a bunch of nervous municipal officials who say, no, this could really damage the ability of governments to negotiate with public sector employees.
And just a real quick last question on this, Colin. I mean, is there any real way, though, to prove intent of a governor faced with a massive deficit, whether it's a Democratic governor or a Republican governor, whether or not labor relations have been good in the past or bad in the past, to prove intent in a case like this?
Well, I think you ask people to connect. You ask judges, you ask juries, judges in this case, to connect the dots, right? I mean, one of the arguments I think that Golub uses is this is how he even in his letter, I think, says this is how you did your layoffs most recently.
Yes.
This is you guys did your – the Malloy administration did their layoffs. This is how the Roland administration did their layoffs, and there really is a substantive difference.
Roland did not want to do a deposition, so he signed – they stipulated to certain facts, and those facts are in the record, and they indicate that Roland, yes, was very conscious of who was in a union that he laid off and who wasn't, and that's one of the problems here. They do have a record that's somewhat damaging.
We're talking in the wheelhouse today with Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, with Colin McEnroe from WNPR's The Colin McEnroe Show, and with Jeff Cohen, our Capital Region reporter here. We're going to get to some of your calls and questions in a moment at 860-275-7266. But moving on to something else plaguing the Malloy administration right now, Paz, a few different campaign contributions, including from Northeast Utilities executives that have a number of Republicans raising some flags, some question marks as we head into this election year. Maybe you could just take us through this story a little bit, the NU story first.
Yeah, I went back last night. Starting in October, I think I've written five stories kind of trying to go deeper into the Democratic fundraising. NU executives, really after Thomas May, the new CEO, the merger with NSTAR NU, the CEO is an NSTAR guy, different political culture. This is a guy who's used to writing political checks. The culture in Connecticut with NU and United Illuminating is you rarely see these guys writing big checks to the two political parties. So what happened this year is that top executives at Northeast Utilities, they're the number one givers to the Connecticut Democratic Party. Governor Malloy and the party have been beefing up their operations. They've been hiring staff. They're building their ground game to help Malloy when he runs, as well as every other Democrat running for state office next year. The issue has been a return to the sense that pay to play is back in vogue. And what that means isn't quid pro quo, because quid pro quo means you go to jail. Pay to play is more a nuanced understanding. It's you know, you ask people to give who have dealings with the state, and unless you're a complete idiot, you don't strong arm them and say, if you don't give, bad things are going to happen. But, you know, sometimes donors, when given such a request, they will pony up. I mean, it was the case with Governor O'Neill back in the early 1980s, where he got a ton of money from people who did business with the state DOT. Governor Rowland was a very successful fundraiser. Jody Rell really wasn't that interested. But Governor Malloy is really more in the model of Rowland and O'Neill. He's working very hard to raise money. And he's repeatedly said his only standard is meeting the law. You know, I asked him the other day, I said, what about perception? You have instances where a real estate construction manager writes a check for $10,000 to the Connecticut Democratic Party the day before the State Bond Commission is going to vote on a $31 million financing package for a tenant into this guy's project in Bridgeport. How do you think that looks to the public? You know, but Malloy said the standard they must meet is the law, and that's all he's worried about.
Okay, so to talk about that standard column, there's the law, mm-hmm. and then there's the perception. Are we in these two particular cases, the cases of NU or the cases of this particular $10,000 contribution from Edward Snyder, chief executive of Comcast Spectacor, the subsidiary manages the XL Center in Rensselaer Field. I mean, are these things getting around the law, or is it just a perception problem in your mind?
Well, first of all, Mr. May's email is kind of bizarre in the sense that it goes on and on about what a great guy Dan Malloy is, what a great governor Dan Malloy is. And then it says, make out your checks to the State Democratic Party, hyphen federal. Now, there's a reason for this, which is that because of all the things that Paz is describing, they're not supposed to give to the state side. So he's actually asking his employees to give to the part of the State Democratic Party that underwrites federal campaigns for like Congress and Senate and stuff like that.
There's a lot of spillover, though, because all the operational stuff, and that's legal, but I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, that's my point, which is that, you know, we're talking about threading a needle here, and we're talking about threading a needle in a pretty disingenuous way. I mean, to say, well, this is all for Dan Malloy, but make it out for federal. You are admitting at this point to the people who are receiving this email that you're playing a game right now. You're asking them to give money to a fund that's not for the guy that you're talking about, with the expectation that he will somehow, in a way that he's really kind of not supposed to, benefit from it.
Because this is a two-part system. The governor, when he finally announces for re-election, he's going to be a publicly financed candidate who can accept maximum donations of $100. The other piece of it is the party can raise money at maximum clip of $10,000.
And that's more than they used to be able to raise.
Right. Well, it's the same federal limit. It's new, the state. They doubled it in the state from $5,000 to $10,000. And the parties can make unlimited independent expenditures in support of their candidates, both for legislature and governor. So that's the tension here. You have this publicly financed system, which was really held up as a national model. And now you have alongside of it big, big money. And the governor has a foot in both worlds. He's raising money for the party, which is perfectly legal. And in fact, while some Republicans who are running for office are criticizing him, other Republican operatives are actually applauding him and saying, this is what the guy should be doing. He ought to be building his party structure. Our party is in disarray. So that's the big picture here.
But I think the overarching problem, and this isn't specific to these emails or to the $10,000 thing, but it is that in covering this campaign, we're going to be playing a game of whack-a-mole. You know, this is going to be a post-Citizens United gubernatorial campaign. And I think one of the issues as we cover Governor Malloy's campaign is, where's all the money? You know, because it's not even just in these places. Obviously, there's other sources of independent expenditures. There's that whole post-Citizens United web of ways that money can be spent on behalf of a candidate without coordination with the campaign. I think you're going to see a lot of that in this campaign.
Well, and you already have it with the Democratic Governors Association. You know, the governor held a meeting, they called it a policy conference in Hartford, and these are all big corporations that pony up. And to get access to this, to some of the meetings, you had to be a sponsor for $10,000, or you had to be a member at one of the elite levels that cost $100,000 or $250,000.
Isn't it great that companies can be members of the Democratic Governors Association?
Yes, and Republican. So you're going to see big spending here by the DGA and the RGA. In New Hampshire, both groups spent last year in excess of $7 million each. In Connecticut 4 years ago, it was less than $2 million. So, again, you're going to have public financing, which is going to give the nominees $6 million for the general election, and then you're going to see this ocean of independent money.
I think we should gather together some. I'd like to join one of these groups. I'd like to get in a Governor's Association.
Well, I was looking at the fundraising appeal for the Mirror, and it had these different levels, and I was laughing because it really looked like the DGA one, except that, you know, ours started at $25.
Yeah, it's the same thing for us. It's $60, and yeah, you get a Colin McEnroe mug.
Right.
Colin McEnroe is here, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Mark Pazniokas, he's from the Connecticut Mirror, Capital Bureau Chief there. You can read his work at ctmirror.org. Jeff Cohen is WNPR's Capital Region Reporter. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the one-year anniversary of the tragedy at Sandy Hook Elementary and some of the things that we're looking at as we head into that anniversary. We're also going to be remembering, as much of the rest of the world is, a former South African leader, Nelson Mandela. That's coming up next on The Wheelhouse here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, you can join us in downtown Hartford live from our iConnect downtown storefront. We'll be kicking off an evening of pop-up shopping, the Small Business Night Out. We'll be previewing a community conversation looking at how we're shaped by our surroundings. And we'll also be looking at the progress of Create Here Now, a placemaking initiative happening in 20 communities around the state. Join us downtown right on Trumbull Street in front of the Excel Center in downtown Hartford for tomorrow's Where We Live. It's also where Colin McEnroe is going to be broadcasting from tomorrow. What's coming up on today's show, Colin?
Our show today is about singing together. We're heading into the heart of Handel's Messiah season, but we're going to do a show about sort of the emotional benefits and the health benefits and the neurological benefits of singing with other people in choirs and chorales and stuff.
Excellent.
Like that.
That's Colin McEnroe this afternoon at 1 o'clock on WNPR. Joining me also in the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable today, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, and Jeff Cohen, he's WNPR's Capital Region Reporter. This Saturday is the one-year anniversary of the tragedy at Sandy Hook Elementary. We're going to be broadcasting live for 3 hours on Saturday morning, bringing you memories and remembrances and taking your phone calls as well. That's Saturday morning here on WNPR. It's been in the news for a number of reasons throughout the course of the last couple of weeks. And here is a first selectman of Newtown, Pat Loggia, addressing directly the media.
The community needs time to be alone and to reflect on our past year in personal ways without a camera or a microphone. There's an emotional and economic toll that we pay when the media descends on us, so we ask for your forbearance after today and respectfully request that you allow us a time of peace and quiet.
That's Newtown's first selectwoman, Pat Loggia, addressing the media, essentially saying stay away on the day of the anniversary. Newtown itself has said they're not going to have any major events happening that day. The governor is expected to announce that there will be a ringing of the bells at 9:30 statewide. Jeff, just very quickly to go through some of this. I know that you got a chance to talk to the governor just a few days ago for a story that you're working on for NPR. As he's looking back at this year and looking ahead at this anniversary, what are some things he's thinking about?
Well, we walked through the day itself, and it was interesting to talk to him about things that he recalled that surprised him about the day. Excuse me. One of the things was that, he arrived on scene and there wasn't a perimeter yet. No one was in charge. That had not yet been decided that the state police would take over the investigation. So people were sort of everywhere. And he said he didn't stop getting new information until 5 o'clock that afternoon. So talking to him about that process was interesting. He reflected back on his decision to inform families that their loved ones, if you were still in that firehouse near the school, that your loved ones wouldn't be coming back. That's a decision that I think has weighed on him since he made it. I think he's comfortable with it, but it's certainly something that caused him some angst. But when you ask him the question, do we know Adam Lanza any better now than we did a year ago?
Which is really the story that you're working on for NPR for this Friday. Yeah.
That's right. He's pretty resolute. He went pretty quickly back to almost a gun stump answer, which was, here is a person who was deeply disturbed who had far too easy access to guns. And in his mind, that is who Adam Lanza was, a person with deep mental health issues, some diagnosed perhaps, but maybe most of them not. Obviously, we don't know a whole lot about diagnoses, with far too much access to guns. He said his mother's decision to buy him a gun for the holidays that year, since he didn't have a permit, and assuming he wouldn't have gotten a permit before the 25th, was illegal then and is illegal now as a straw purchase. So he's still very resolute on the issues of guns.
You know, Colin, we've been thinking about this an awful lot over the course of the last week. Last Wednesday in the Wheelhouse, we were waiting for the release of these 911 tapes, and we got a chance to hear them that afternoon. And in the context of some of what the governor has said over this past year and what we've heard a lot from First Select Woman Pat Lodra, I just wanted to maybe talk with you a little bit about a reflection on this, and we're going to go deeper into this on Saturday's program. The fact of the matter is when we heard those tapes, we listened to what seemingly were fairly heroic stories of people, janitors and school personnel, shielding kids from harm, saving people. There was indeed horror on those tapes, but there was not the gratuitous type of violence that we might have expected. I guess I'm just wondering if any minds are changing here over the course of this last week or maybe even over this last year, as we're being asked to stay away from the media standpoint this upcoming Saturday. I feel as though there's an awful lot in my mind, at least, that's sort of changed about this event over the course of the last week. I just guess I'm just wondering if you might reflect a little bit on some of the things we've been thinking about.
I guess one of the lessons that I learned this year was how intractable we are on certain things, you know, and rather than bringing us together as a state or as a nation around certain issues, especially the gun issue, this event divided us to an astonishing degree. And it really, you know, illustrated maybe, at least in modern times, in the times that we live in, the impossibility of making significant progress on this. So that, you know, right now Congress is about to consider, you know, a pretty minimal bill on plastic guns, you know, and even that one is having all
plastic guns that would not be picked up by metal detectors,
yeah,
for instance.
Even that one seems doomed to failure due to, you know, some complex amendment process. I hate to sound hopeless, but to me, one of the lessons of this is, wow, it did not unite us.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll sort of grab on to sort of a bright spot in this, and that's Pat Lodra,
yeah,
who has turned out to be sort of the archetype of what you would hope that a small town leader would be, that starting back in the summer, she has guided this town away from becoming this museum of grief and returning it to a functioning community. And she's done that with a number of, you know, resolute steps and statements in a very, you know, kind of homespun, low-key way. And I think she's the one figure that everybody can rally around to a little bit. And yes, Colin, as soon as you talk about gun control, any of those feelings quickly go away.
Yeah. As I said, we're going to be talking more about this issue coming up on Saturday's special program here on WNPR. You can find out more at WNPR.org. Last thing for today's program, of course, we were looking ahead at this Newtown anniversary. We've been looking back throughout the course of this week at the life of Nelson Mandela, the great South African leader. And it seems in some ways his work and his life has touched very many of us in different ways. Colin, you wrote a beautiful piece that I got a chance to read about a brief encounter. And I'm wondering if you can just relay that story to our listeners who maybe didn't get a chance to read it.
Well, of course, this piece, talking about my life being touched, this all happened when Paz and I were sharing a hotel room, which also...
And we've each signed non-disclosure forms, so don't even ask.
Touched my life deeply, but yes, the Connecticut caucus at the 1992 Democratic National Convention welcomed Nelson Mandela. There wasn't a lot of advance warning about this either.
There was none. Yeah.
And we showed up there, and there he was, and he gave, you know, as usual, a very uplifting speech. But I don't know what instinct possessed me to do this, but I left the speech early and went out into the hallway. I just wanted to watch him leave. I wasn't quite sure. And in the hallway, where it was virtually every service employee, every minimum wage employee of that hotel, and this is a hotel which probably had a lot of famous people going through it, and I'm sure they have never done this before, but every waiter, every busboy, every chambermaid, everybody was out there waiting to watch Nelson Mandela walk by and to shake his hand, and he did stop, and he shook hands all the way down the hall.
And my memory of that, and what I wrote about this week was recalling how the delegates were just, to put it bluntly, were bitching and moaning about their week. You know, they were all tired. The leader of the party had failed to provide Danish that morning. The alternates were complaining about their seats. And then in walks this man who had been in prison for 27 years. And in some ways, you could say, in the service of democracy, of attempting to achieve democracy. And the room just transformed instantly. I got hold of Miles Rappaport and Jan Parker, two of the people who were there that day, who I wrote about, you know, 21 years ago. And they still vividly remembered. I mean, Jan Parker was this is Henry Parker's wife, the former treasurer. And she just was able to, like, float up onto this little riser. Security tried to block her, and Mandela pulled her up. And she was speechless. And the tears were streaming down her face. I mean, like, it was a waterfall. It went down her cheeks, down her neck. And Mandela just patted her on the back and just said, yes, yes, I understand.
You know, it's interesting, Colin, just the last little bit of time we have left. The idea – we talk about politics and politicians and – things that they do and don't do well all the time here on the Wheelhouse and on Where We Live. Is he one of the last, or maybe the last, of a breed of transformative leaders who bridge politics and also something that's beyond politics that has to do with true leadership, almost some sort of a religious figure in a way?
I think he was. I mean, you can certainly find a different climate of opinion. I mean, there's been a spate of stories this week saying that his image in America is more sanitized than it is elsewhere. But
absolutely.
Certainly in terms of how he presented himself. I wrote in the piece, you know, we're never supposed to sort of do the fan thing and shake people's hands and stuff. But watching him speak in that hotel room, watching him speak to the caucus, I really wanted to shake this guy's hand. That was the other thing I was doing out in the hall. And there was something very, very special about him. And I think, like the Dalai Lama, these are both guys who have suffered and seen their people suffer and yet radiated a kind of joy and tranquility that seemed very, very improbable. And maybe that's the special thing you're talking about.
And he clearly was a mixed figure as president, handling such mundane things as the economy and whatnot. But he was such a symbol of coming out of prison after 27 years with a Gandhi-like approach. And if you look at the history of Africa post-colonial, you know, transition from white minority to black majority, it's an awful history. It almost always ends in spasms of violence. And South Africa under Mandela largely, not entirely, but largely avoided that.
Now, as we end here, I wanted to let people know that if you want to hear a really interesting story about a visit to his former cell in Robben Island, you can go to WNPR.org. Our reporter Tom Verde was there. We also want to just quickly end with this. This is how a CBS Morning program ended a segment about the funeral of Nelson Mandela the other day.
Memorial for Nelson Mandela. It's coming up next on CBS This Morning.
Well, Jeff Cohen, you and I are about the same age. You recognize the song that they're playing there?
You're a little older than I am, John.
Just a couple years old.
I just want to get that out there.
Yeah.
I mean, I recognize the song.
Yeah.
What are you?
The song is Africa by the band Toto. And it has, let's just say, generated a lot of comment in the Twitter sphere about whether or not that was the appropriate song to play.
Two members from Weathersfield.
should have had them on the show today.
We have a winner.
The Porcaro Brothers.
If you are in the band Toto or were in the band Toto, you can feel free to call us maybe on next week's Wheelhouse. So as we end our program today, let's just listen to a little bit of Hugh Masekela. This is a song he wrote back in 1987. He could have gone to jail for putting this out. He wanted to free Nelson Mandela. This is probably the sort of song that you play as you decide to commemorate his life. Let's listen to a little bit of that as I say goodbye to Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Jeff Cohen, WNPR's Capital Region reporter, and Mark Pasniokas, the Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Thank you all very much.